Good to be with you, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am Katerina Stoikova, the creator and the host, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My brilliant guest today is Tony Krunk, Kentucky poet and nonfiction writer and all-around creative person. Hi, Tony. Welcome to Accents.
Hey, Katerina, thank you so much. I appreciate the introduction. Some of it's true.
Most recently, you're the author of Hopkinsville, a memoir in prose poetry. You refer to it as the book closest to your heart. Tell us more.
It's closest to my heart because the primary motivation for my writing it was I have a young son. And as it turns out, I'm going to be the only source he's going to have for, the lore and the stories and the history of this side of his family. And so, as I, begin aging myself, I began to feel the urgency of recording some of that family history for him. But I also wanted to try to record some kind of leave some kind of record of what the experience for me was like growing up in that place at that time in that family. So I felt I wouldn't do justice to both if I only wrote kind of a nonfiction chronicle family history. And there are certain things that only poetry can do in terms of trying to do justice to certain kinds of memories, if that makes any sense. So just by virtue of the subject matter and what I wanted to do with the subject matter, I had to kind of come up with some kind of hybrid form by which I could tell stories, but through a medium that was plastic enough and expressive enough to really do justice to what I wanted to accomplish in the book.
And how did you go about doing it? Did you let the memories surface as they wanted to, or did you do it in more methodical way?
To go back to your first question, another reason this book is so dear to my heart is because I've been trying to write it for a very long time. Because in addition to attempting to chronicle some family history, it's also, in a sense, my homage and my act of respect and appreciation and gratitude to those people and that place that made me who I am. And so the way I wrote this book is the way I write everything, through a process of collage. When some memory has come to me over the years, I've written it down and chucked it in a file box marked. It used to be marked New Orphan Train because I thought that was going to be the original title of this book. But the file box of notes and stuff I've got off in the closet, where all of my Hopkinsville stuff has been accumulating over the decades, that's why I had time on my hand. I had the urgency, I had the need to sit down and finally write this book. And so that was a matter of sitting down, and there you go. There was the subject matter and a large part of the text. And I just sifted through the notes. And of course, going through that process was a whole nother depth of iteration of memory, because each one of those scraps of paper triggered other memories. So it was an archaeological project in that sense, if that makes sense. Digging through the old boxes and seeing what needed to be recorded from that accumulated, sporadic, fragmented memory, if that makes any sense. And so, of course, I'm not a fiction writer. I'm not that good a narrative writer. But the tools I had at hand were the tools of poetry, in which the search was on to find bits and notes and memories that resonated with each other, such that they would suggest, an ambiance or a larger picture, or the feel or taste of an experience, in ways that only poetry can.
I love this book. It is emotional and beautiful and impactful. And I don't think that anybody who has read even one of the stories in it, one of the prose poems in it, can ever forget Hopkinsville, or the characters there, or the way of life, or the sheer love towards the place that the main character has.
I appreciate that. I wanted to compose a book out of the aspects of that place and the experience that I loved. And I was asked this recently when I gave a reading from this. Somebody asked me, well, what about the ugly parts of town? So there were some things going on in the mid 1960s in small rural southern towns that didn't make it into this book except by refraction, right? And so I was asked, what about the other side of this? That's not the kind of book I wanted to write. It's not the kind of book I wanted to write. But if I may, before we leave, the last question. I'm sorry to keep leapfrogging backwards, but in terms of the evolution of this book, I cannot let that history of that book go without reminding you what I don't need to remind you of your role as editor in the evolution of that book. As you recall, I don't, I mean, no, recall how many years ago it was, 3, 4 years ago, I sent you a sheaf of about, I don't know, 35, 36 pages of 6 or 8 prose pieces. And I asked you, Katerina, is this a book? And you and your kindness said no. No, it isn't, but there's a story going on here that I'm kind of curious about and I'd like to find out more, right? And that, Katerina, and I've expressed this to you a number of times in a number of ways, that was critically important to me as a writer because that, in some sense, gave me the green light that there was something there that would resonate with the readers. And it also, in a much more resonant, deeply resonant way, it gave me permission to go ahead and swallow all the reservations and the fears that I'd always had about trying to take this book on. And no, I've Katerina says it's there, and now the jig is up and the card is out on the table. I got to follow up. And so with your guidance over several iterations, the book took shape. And so I can't, let any mention of this book go by without mentioning your guidance of it into existence, and in doing so, you do what I know you do with all of your writers. You do what editors were sent here by their Lord and Creator to do, in addition to all the millions of other things that you do. So this book would not exist without you, and I appreciate that.
You're so kind to say that, Tony. When I saw the initial book, it was a chapbook of prose poems, and I fell in love with them immediately, and I wanted to talk to you to say there is so much more about this that I can read. And you took it and ran with it.
Well, I had the file box full of the stuff, ready to go. All I needed to do is pop the lid, and there it was. And it was a it was I have to say it was a grand experience, not just in my writing life, but in my personal life, that was really deeply meaningful in so many ways. And I'm grateful for your journeying with me on that project. So thank you.
Thank you. Would you read us a little bit from the book?
The latent story through the whole thing is my mother's history, and I know more of her history because she was the talker in the family, she was the keeper of the stories for both sides of the family because my father, dear man that he was not a talker, and so most of what I have. Much of what I have about the entire family's history comes from my mother and grandmothers and whatnot. But the kind of underlying narrative of the whole memoir is my mother's story. The first piece is entitled Hobo Signs. It was my mother's job to look for hobo signs. They would be scratched on the wall of the shed or on one of the trash barrels or one of the fence slats with chalk or charcoal or a knife. She even found them scratched into the cross ties of the tracks running just behind the fence. She didn't know what any of them meant, but she knew they told you whether you were welcome at a certain house, whether it was a good place to stop for food or clothes or work, or whether it was best not to stop. Her job was to rub them off or scratch over them so you couldn't tell what they were. Her father said he didn't mind helping a man out, but he wasn't running a tramp hotel either. And since he was a preacher, they were likely to get more traffic than most anyway. If one did come to the door, they would try to give him something if they could, but there were many times they just didn't have anything to give. My mother once watched her mother give a man the bowl of cornbread batter she was stirring up for supper, the only thing she had that she could part with. Her mother didn't like the looks of the man when he came to the door asking for something to eat, wouldn't let him in the house, so told him to come around to the kitchen window where she handed the bowl and the wooden mixing spoon out to him. The man sat under the shade tree in the yard and scooped the batter into his mouth, left the empty bowl and spoon in the grass, and went on his way. They would pass by most often in the late afternoon or early evening, headed for the camping place they had down the tracks a ways beyond the cemetery at the edge of town. The camp was just a clearing in some scrub pine where they could have a fire. They had put up a couple of lean-tos with some old sheet tin and lumber scraps and tar paper. Sometimes people would take a box of old clothes or some food out and leave it for them. My mother always knew she was adopted. Doesn't remember anybody telling her that much, and her mother reminded her of it often enough. They told her they had gotten her at an orphanage in Louisville. She says that at some point she began to be afraid. Afraid that if her mother and father had gotten her at an orphanage, then they could take her back any time they wanted, any time she did something that made them sorry they had gotten her. And she would wonder, of course, where her real mother and father were. She figured that her mother must have died because mothers don't just give their children away. But she thought her father might still be out there somewhere. She started to wonder whether he might be one of them, if he might come walking down the tracks one evening and see her and stop for her. He would tell her other mother and father that he had come to get her, to take her back home. She would go inside and gather up her belongings while he waited for her. She would come out and kiss her other mother and father and tell them thank you. They would be crying, and then the two of them would set off together, disappearing down the tracks. She started keeping all her important things. Her Pinky and Blue Boy paper dolls, the painted thimbles her grandmother had given her Sunday hair clips, all together in a shoebox under her bed that she could just pick up and walk out with if she had to. She started sitting on the back steps as late into the evening as she was let to, watching the tracks. She wondered if there was a hobo sign that meant, "Stop here. Your lost daughter lives here." She wondered whether he would stop if he saw it scratched into one of the fence slats. One evening, my mother and a couple of her friends snuck down the tracks to the cemetery to spy on the hobo camp. They hid in the trees and watched them, dark shadows shaped like men sitting, leaning into their fire, holding their hands over it, hunched against the chill, their faces and their hands lit up. They scared her, the look of them. That night and several nights afterward, she lay awake as long as she could, not wanting to sleep, afraid that she would dream of them stepping out of the darkness. But then she began to think that if her real father were one of them, that is how he would come to her. Out of the black trees and across the tracks toward her, his face lit yellow and flickering, his body a shadow, his shining hands reaching for her. She knew that she would still go to him.
This story moves me so much. I can picture the girl, I can picture the family. I love her little treasures that she is ready to go with, that little thimble. Just amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's been an exercise in coming to understand how memory works, and it doesn't work the way we often assume it does. It's those vivid sensory details that kept coming back to me over and over again. A lot of which I had forgotten that I had seen or smelt. They were kind of mixed in with that box of notes in that file box, but the more I remembered, the more those vivid sense details came back to me. And with that, a sense of kind of the ambiance of where I was and what the people around me were like. And I was surprised at how vivid the sense memories have been in doing that archaeology.
Read that the other one.
We get mother's my mother's birth and her significant events in her life and significant events in my life growing up in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, in the late 1950s, early 60s. But the last three pieces in the book are kind of a suite of pieces that constitute, in a sense, my last farewell, in a sense. So this is the second of the three, and it's entitled Sunrise Service. Some things happen in life that sound made up when you tell them. The moment is somehow too composed, too coincidental, the poignancy too convenient. So with the last time I saw my mother, I had come to Hopkinsville the week before her birthday in November. She was bedridden by then, but still at home at my sister's house and in good spirits. We'd had a good visit. I left early Sunday, as usual, for the long day's drive ahead. That morning, I'd gotten away early enough before dawn to take a favorite route out of town through South County, 20 or so miles to the interstate. A narrow two-lane winding through farmland and forest patches, the road I would have taken to my friend's farm. A slow drive at best, the back roads and creek crossings, the mud ponds and ruined barns of life's landmarks, unrecognizable as such to others, but familiar and memory-worn to me. The drive had gotten even more slow in recent years as South County had become home to a growing Mennonite community. A number of families moving down from Indiana and Ohio mostly, buying and recultivating the land from the many farms like my friends that had gone under during one or another farm crisis some 30, 40 years before. Their black horse-drawn buggies had become a familiar sight in town, as well as on the county's roads, and so were a familiar caution. That morning, the fields had settled into the first real cold of winter, thin frost dusting the soybean and corn stubble, rimming the pond edges, spreads of low fog here and there over the sinks and shallows, the narrow road weaving but roughly following along the river south and west, dawn beginning to gray the sky, kitchen lights coming on in the houses along the road and scattered among the trees. Coming into a wide, blind curve, I know by the droppings in the road to slow and watch for them. And coming out of the bend, I see them in the lane ahead of me, a quarter mile down a long, straight stretch, a line of black buggies. Three, four, no, the full length of them coming into view. Six black buggies all clopping steadily, patiently along, as if in procession. I slow, keep distance, unsafe to pass, which I wouldn't do anyway for fear of spooking the horses. From that far back, I could still see their white breath huffing into the chill air. Can see the black hats and bonnets, the blankets about the shoulders of the little families bundled in the seats under the buggy canopies. And then off to the right, a low rise, a hill, and coming into view, a wood-framed church house. A gravel lane up to it, and there another line of them. Two, three more black buggies rolling in a line up the lane, a scattering of others already parked in the churchyard, blankets on the horses, one or two with feed bags. An elder couple scuttering in, the church house door opened and shut quickly against the cold. And so I follow, and at such distance. One by one they turn, then the line of black buggies in front of me, off the hard road, up the gravel lane to the church house, the first, then a second following, the line slowing as the horses make the corner, a third, then the next, and the next. One by one, the line of them reforming now, rolling up the low ridge, and then the last, six black carriages in all. Horses steaming in the November dawn to church, to sunrise service, the black procession of them passing one by one, stately as death, steadfast, eternal as life.
Stunning, beautiful, amazing writing, Tony. What do readers in Hopkinsville think of the book?
I do have friends that I have known from our shared childhood in Hopkinsville, who have, like myself, have not lived there in a very long time. The couple of those who are still amongst my dearest have had nice things to say about it. And they've asked me also, well, why did you leave out all the ugly stuff? Those couple of people who do know the place and know the time and the era feel that I did justice to the ambiance of the place. And I know myself, I did justice to the family history. So anyway, I'm sorry.
And
Continue.
that's good. I think it's good.
Long answer to a short question.
Richard Taylor, the poet, and I were talking once, and he said to me, "You know, Katerina, I'm a poet of place, and you're a poet of being. You, Tony, I think you have books of place, Hopkinsville, and books of being, like Biblia Pauperum." What do you think of this distinction, poets of place versus poets of being?
As you as Richard has identified you as one of the latter, what does he mean by that? And what do you mean by accepting that moniker? Or do you accept that moniker? A poet of being, that's such an interesting idea. Richard's a clever man.
Well, that conversation started with how much he likes his house and how much he knows his surroundings and the trees, and where in the afternoon the shade will be of his trees. And I guess he's so rooted in tradition. And me, being an immigrant, I am
Yes.
quite literally uprooted. And what I write about is about mental stuff.
Yes. Okay. Stuff you can carry with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you know, I that is okay. I understand the distinction now. And what an interesting distinction. And if Richard's talking about the house, I think he's talking about it is a lovely place, and I would never leave there. I would never leave there. Not just the beauty of the place, but the history of it, but whatever. But you as an immigrant into this country, and I have had reverse experiences, because I, like Richard, or let me say, Richard adjacently, I was born into a town and a family and a culture which was very, and I mean this not as a criticism, because it had its very positive side. It's very insular. Most everything that most folks needed culturally was right there, right? And those places are one of the words that they go by is community, right? Because they are the keepers of the stories and the keepers of the traditions and the keepers of the relationships that keep the human community going. And I'm from one of those places, and I grew up in one of those places. And looking back on it now, I am so grateful to have had that experience and to have grown up there. But once I grew up there, the flip side of it, of insularity, came to bear in my life. And I'm sorry, but I just was at a point, like many people are in certain kind of limited situations, felt that my life needed to go somewhere else and needed to be involved in other things than were available in this beautiful, beloved insular community. So for me, for reasons better and worse, I knew I both had to leave that place, but on the other hand, could not bring myself to. And that has been one of the kind of, if you may, kind of existential struggles of the self-exile, which may or may not be the immigrant story. But I left a place that I, at the time, I saw only the ugly and mean in it. Well, I wouldn't say only, but I saw the ugly and mean in addition to the beloved and the close and the supporting and the nurturing. But in, I had to get away from that place and go somewhere else. And so I have carried with me both the gratitude for having lived there and for those people, as lovely and beautiful as they were to me, and the guilt of not being able to stay there. And so I here's a joke I make, with my son. If I ever get around to actually writing my autobiography, it's going to be entitled My Life in 34 Permanent Addresses to Date, right? Because I've lived in 34 different places, Katarina. Not by intention. I didn't want to be, that's, we're talking about all just a little bit over 2 years per place, right? I didn't want it to be that way. It's just kind of the way it turned out. So I have, whatever has motivated my life as a writer or as a human being, I've had to carry with me also, if that makes any sense. But one of the things I've carried with me is this dynamic curse and blessing of carrying with me a place that I couldn't live in. And that includes all my relations with my family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, I feel as though I have tried to find a way to integrate the two through my writing, to both pay homage to the place, but also apologize for leaving.
There is both triumph and tragedy in what you said. And I,
It
yeah,
makes
there's,
good art,
well, what was said before us, be in this place, but not of it.
There you go. And I'm thinking of James Wright's line, whatever, what was the name of his hometown? It's a great place to be from. Right. So it's, but that, but that, yeah, that has, that's just been a driving dynamic in my whole psychology. And I've, and I have helped pay the mortgage for a lot of psychotherapists over the years trying to figure that out. But I got it figured out, and Hopkinsville was a triumph. A personal triumph in that regard. I've made peace with it all, Katerina. I've made peace with it.
That's priceless. And what is the value of passing through a place?
I don't. First of all, it may have value, but it's certainly not by choice, because we, what's the koan? We're ever progressing, ever arriving, right? Because there's no, change is the only permanence, et cetera. We're always passing through. But there's something to be said of one's being aware that one is passing through a certain time and a certain place and a certain phase of one's life. And I think that was my farewell to Hopkinsville, but also, I'm sorry. Hopkinsville is, it was a place that I passed through, and everybody's childhood place of origin is a place they pass through, or not. Right. Right. So, just passing through, with gratitude, always with gratitude, always with gratitude.
Talk about the continuum of poetry, prose poetry, lyrical essay, flash fiction, flash nonfiction.
Oh, dear heavens. I don't know. And I mean, you kind of ch had to chew on this when we decided what to put on the back cover of Hopkinsville. And I appreciate your kindness, because I think it was my proposal to call it a memoir in prose poems. And I had to do that because I couldn't call it nonfiction. Because, because memory is so fallible. And I don't know how memoirists get away with calling what they write nonfiction, Because my experience of trying to write from especially early memories, it's all fuzzy. And the language you try to use to capture it is all fuzzy. But so I didn't want anybody to think that this was entirely factual, because by virtue of the nature of facts, it couldn't be. Okay, but anyway, so I don't know what the I don't know what the where the boundaries between the genres lie. And when I've been asked that question before, not to be rude about it, I've said, I'm sorry, I don't know. My job is to write the books, and it's up to somebody else to figure out what shelf in the bookstore to put them on, right? And I have purposely and joyfully over the years done my best to play around with the boundaries of genres and kind of seeing what poetry, how far you can push poetry into the prose of Hopkinsville, or by virtue, how far can you push a group of words towards away from narrative and still call them a poem? I mean, I've experimented with the genres all, ever since I've been writing. So I don't know where the boundaries are, but I'll tell you, it's a lot of fun to play with them and to surprise people.
You have written Art for Decent Folk that arrived in my mailbox. I have to tell you, it is pure genius.
Oh,
I love it.
those are pretty much fresh off the presses, Katerina. I was so hoping you would receive those before we got a chance to talk, but you found a few things to amuse you in there, I hope.
It is amusing. It is non-self-conscious. It has the pure joy of being creative and smart and inventive and brief. I mean, I would love for you to read some from that if you wouldn't mind.
May I?
Yeah.
Oh, these books are a result of a graphic arts project that I and a couple of dear friends have been working on of late. My friend Jeff Bradford, who's a writer and an artist and a retired advertising mogul, and our technologically gifted associate Will Walker down in Clarksville, Tennessee. We just now, just in the last couple of weeks, launched our internet presence, calling ourselves Art for Decent Folk. And
Great.
here's the pitch. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Friends, are you decent? Wished you lived in a decent world? Then you too can be an ambassador of decency. Buy Art for Decent Folk products and share the gospel of good humor and good sense. If you are decent, you will enjoy visiting artfordecentfolk.com for all your stationery, novelty apparel, and literary needs. And remember, friends, buy only Art for Decent Folk products. Ain't none better, because ain't nary like them. How's that? Anyway, we're having a lot of fun with this. But this is, this is, here's the why. This is really the first one that I decided to put together. I call it Analects, and I pointedly put it together for my creative writing students, because back when I was teaching full time in the academy, one of the things I would do in my workshops is I would write down something I would call my Analect for the week, and make copies of it on a note card and distribute the note cards to all my students, and we'd all read it and talk about that Analect for the week. And the Analect was usually something about the creative process or something about poetry or whatnot. And over time, that evolved into this collection of Analects. Analects by T. Kronk, for poets and others. Instructions. Read instructions before proceeding. Instructions two. Number one, reduce. Number two, simplify. How to avoid the abyss. One, pretend something is important. Two, devote your life to it. On inspiration, the heat is in the coal, not the flame. What to write? One, what you know. Two, make up the rest. What to look for? One, detail. Two, pattern. Repeat. Rules of Earth. One, people are often stupid. Two, traffic generally is bad. On ethics. When in doubt, be polite. How to get there? One, start here. Two, keep going. Bus station mantra. We are now here. We are nowhere. Repeat. On theory, beware the spawn of theory, for they are fishy. On postmodernism, when we have nothing to say, we talk about how to say things. That's a sampling of stuff that would never be published anywhere else, Katarina.
I don't know if you had sent me those. I love them.
Oh, good. Well, we have t-shirts and bumper stickers as well. So
Yeah.
stock up, you know, it's never too early to shop for Christmas. So
I would definitely check out that website. And the work is brilliant. The stories, such interesting voice. It shows that you're a poet because, I mean, you have made them so tight and so effective. But also, I can see in them the joy of creation, of no pressure, absolute liberation about, how people will read it and accept it or not accept it or publish it or sell it or blah, blah, blah. It's,
Well, I appreciate that.
yeah.
Coming from somebody who makes at least a part of your living from selling books, I especially appreciate your saying that. But and it's not to be immodest about it, but there is some the aphorism is a very old and ancient literary form, and so you read a few aphorisms and it doesn't take long to pick up the knack for that. But also there is the whole concrete poetry movement, which used to be a thing back in the middle of the last century, which is the attempt to integrate poetry with graphics in order to create a kind of a hybrid kind of art form. And so there's a little bit of that in there. So but it's what I've done my entire writing life, Katerina. Find a pile of words and see what you can make out of it.
One thing that interests me from your CV is the unique combination of degrees, from religious studies to philosophy to English and creative writing to clinical mental health counseling. Every one of these deals with the understanding and elevating or healing of the mind.
I think that's fair. There has certainly been an evolution of my interests from one to the other. The reason the degrees have kind of stacked up is because I have a short attention span and I can only stick with one subject for so long, and then I got to go find something else to get interested in. But the continuity there has been the continuity of the evolution of my own interests from starting from trying to critically understand the religious heritage that I was born into, and the tools I needed to do that lay in the field of philosophy, and so I've followed that, and then I found that the tools of philosophy were very useful in trying to figure out art and literature and all my interest in that, and then I got interested in seeing if I could do it myself as a creative writer, and my interest in mental health and that second career in clinical mental health that I undertook came from my experience teaching in community outreach education settings, which I've done, all my adult life. And there you meet some of them in those kind of programs, you meet some of the most interesting people doing some of the most interesting work. Teachers and students alike at a place where writing and thinking about literature and all that stuff, there's something really at stake in ways that it is not in the academy, as much at stake as it may be in the academy. But working with people and working with writing and trying to teach writing outside the academy and, more the street level, brought with it a greater understanding of how writing does the magic that we all know it does, both as writers and teachers. I knew it does it. I know that there's something psycho-emotionally healthy and rich and needful happening when we sit down to write, but seeing it in that broad variety of contexts, it helped me understand, or helped wanted made me want to understand why it works that way. And to do that, you got to get into, psychology and mental health and all of that interesting stuff. And at the same time, if I may, not to be too personal, but I was also getting interested in dealing with my own addiction as a long history alcoholic. And so that took me into a need to understand my own substance use issues, and that's what I specialized in that second career. So it was an exercise not in academic thinking, but in personal need as well. But melding those two together, and in my clinical work, I was able to use writing as the tool to accomplish some of the things that, talk therapy is supposed to accomplish. And I can only do that because I'd had the long history of thinking about creative writing, right? And I knew, and I kind of knew efficient ways to get people to write what they need to write because I've been teaching it forever, right? And seeing that ha and seeing the psycho emotional usefulness of that as a tool has just been amazing. So, they all run together, and it's all me trying to figure out my life and in the world.
I have one last question. And that is a
Please.
question. This is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. And it is, what is the most important th thing you teach your students? If you want them to remember one thing from your class or workshop, what is it?
Oh, wow. If any of my fellow writers who have sat in a workshop or classroom with me, they're going to know exactly what I'm going to say because I say it about 27 times a minute. Whatever your ideas about art and creativity and writing, where they may be, if they are not rooted in the body, they are not rooted, and they're just talk. And it may be good talk. And some of it may even be true talk, but if you cannot root your understanding of why you write and what you're doing when you write and how you write, if that is not rooted in your understanding of the bioorganic rhythms of your life, then you're going to waste a lot of time doing a lot of very inefficient things. Because there is the need for creativity, the urgency of it, right? Are life. They are part and parcel of the definition of life, right? Biologically speaking, not spiritually speaking or intellectually speaking or aesthetically speaking, but you got to understand, you got to have a bioorganic understanding of what creativity is if you really want the process to be efficient for you.
Well, here is a follow-up question. How do you root your poetry into the body?
I may not be the best advertisement for an MFA program because I had a great experience there, and God bless the people who taught me and the people I went to school there with. But I did not learn how to write poetry by studying at Katerina, right? With all those degrees and all those years I spent trying to avoid real work by staying in school, I may have only taken, I mean, after your sophomore, British survey literature classes, I remember one class I took in Renaissance English poetry. And one class I took in modern American poetry. My horrible little confessional secret is I learned to write poetry going to a very good library and pulling books of poetry off the shelf and reading them until I found a poem I liked for whatever reason. I didn't know why. And then deliberately, very deliberately getting out my yellow notepad, my little black Sharpie. And word by word, printing that poem out.
I did that too.
That's how it gets done. And of course, you would do that since this is not your first language. You needed to do it even more than I did. That's exactly how I did it, Katerina. And, don't, I hope you hadn't told nobody. Because when I tell my classes that, like, you see their faces fall. Oh. But no, but my point is, Katerina, my point is, intellectually, I kind of barely knew what I was reading. I was just kind of following what I found of interest, and something in me was needing to find something. And I learned to write poetry through body memory, the same way most people learn to play tennis. You just get out there and whack the ball around forever until your arm knows where to go, Right, I did that. I got a file box. I don't know how many hundreds of pages I copied of poems that way. And it's and I taught my body how to write a poem. No, I'll take my hand taught my brain how to write a poem. In my workshop, my introductory poetry workshops, forever, one of the course requirements is you've got to hand copy printed, not cursive. You've got to slow the process down. That's what you're doing. You're slowing the reading process down. Right, you got to turn in at the end of the semester 20 handwritten block bent pages of poetry, and people hated it first, and once in a while people still hated it at the end of the semester, but by and large most folks said, man, I never knew what a poem was till I did that. And you don't, because we're so used to reading at that rate and slowing it down and putting it in your body instead of in your eyes. It really sinks into your brain, and me and you are the only ones that learned that secret. That's why me and you are so good at what we do.
I'll cut that out.
No, don't you dare. Don't you dare.
I appreciate you so much, Tony. You are you, and you have so much talent and light in you, and you have so much kindness and love and desire to serve. Anybody who spends 5 minutes with you will be changed. I appreciate you.
It is such a nice thing to say. You're going to record that because I'm going to put that in this front hall closet for my son to hear someday. Well, I appreciate Katerina, and I never get tired of telling you how much I appreciate you and love who you are and what you do. And I'll tell you what I tell one or two of my other select friends. You may be one of the reasons I don't get to heaven, because envy with a capital E is one of the cardinal sins, and I just got to watch myself, because the life of art that you are creating and that you are bringing to my beloved home state is just like nothing. And I appreciate you and I love you for it, and I am just grateful and delighted to be any part of anything you ever do. So we'll see you again soon. All right, take care.
You
Good
too.
night.